Last year in Iowa, a record number of toxic blue-green algae blooms in our lakes caused a record number of beach closures. This year, it's predicted to be even worse. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This year, those blue-green algae blooms are expected to be even bigger and more toxic. This hour, we dive in to examine the health of our state's recreational waterways. We'll be joined by Mary Skopek of the Iowa DNR, environmental scientist Peter Thorne of the UI, environmental toxicologist Stuart Schmitz of the Iowa Department of Public Health, among others. Do you boat, fish, swim, ski? Is the water near you safe for recreation? Join our conversation. First, this news. Do you fish, boat, swim, ski in our lakes and rivers? Do you let your pooch take a dip in them? This is an hour of conversation you do not want to miss. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last year in Iowa, a record number of toxic blue-green algae blooms in our lakes caused a record number of beach closures. This year, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, expects those blooms to be even bigger, even more toxic. It's interesting to note that just under half of the state's waterways are on the impaired waters list already. This year, summer just beginning, several of the state's 39 public beaches have been listed as places where swimming is not recommended. This hour on River to River, we take a dive in to examine the health of our state's recreational waterways, and we'd like to have you join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us this hour to lay out the problems, to see what's being done, what might be done better in the future so we can better enjoy our waterways with less risk to ourselves, to our pets. Mary Skopek is with us, beach monitoring coordinator and geologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. She's in our Des Moines studio. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
Also in our Des Moines studio, Stuart Schmitz is a state toxicologist for the Iowa Department of Public Health. Stu, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
Peter Thorne is with us in the Iowa City studio of Iowa Public Radio, professor and head of occupational and environmental health at the University of Iowa. Peter, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Ben.
Mary, let's start with you. Give us a broad overview. What is the state of our recreational water quality in Iowa as we head out to our beaches, as we go to our boats and water skis and all kinds of things?
Well, we monitor our state beaches once a week. So this week I've been out along with our beach technicians, and we look at things like E. coli bacteria as well as the toxins that you were talking about. Currently, we don't have any algal toxin advisories. It's still pretty early in the season, and we've had a lot of rain, which is kind of a good thing when you look at the toxins. They like really calm conditions. The blue-green algae like very warm water, very hot, still conditions. So we haven't really had that yet. But with the forecasted temperatures in the upper 90s by the end of the week, I think we'll really start to see some of these blooms popping, and we really are expecting to see probably advisories, not this week, but probably the week after this.
So the state's beaches that are closed or not advised for swimming are closed due to E. coli rather than these toxins?
Yeah, the current advisories are based on E. coli bacteria, and the E. coli just tells us that there's a potential for increased risk of things like diarrhea, nausea. The E. coli bacteria comes along with, it's not pleasant to say, but fecal contamination. So whether that's human waste that's gotten into the water or animal waste that's gotten into the water, we know that we've got fecal contamination and that the risk of disease is higher because of that E. coli indicator that we saw at those beaches.
Mm-hmm. So when you see along the beach or near the beach where you like to swim, geese and ducks and their excrement, that might be a warning sign.
Absolutely. And that's something that we actually record at our state beaches, is whether we see a lot of the geese droppings. We do have a pilot project at some of our beaches where the state park staff are picking up that the goose dropping so that we're not having that load of geese excrement right there causing a problem. But we don't have that at every beach yet in the state.
Mm-hmm. Stu Schmitz, state toxicologist at the Iowa Department of Health. The state has been monitoring exposure to this blue-green algae in the last few years. What have you seen? What trends have you seen specifically?
Well, I think it's a little early to see the trends. We've been monitoring for the last 8 years or so. It has gone up the last couple years. We request that medical providers, doctor's office, when they see patients that come into their office that are suspected of having blue-green algae poisoning or microcystin poisoning, that be reported to the department. So we see anywhere between 2 and 10 cases every year. That's probably not all the cases. Obviously, there are some that never get reported, but we have seen an uptick in a few cases every year for the last couple years. So,
mm-hmm. When we talk about the difference between getting sick from E. coli and a toxin, this microcystin toxin, what are the different symptoms? How does the body react differently? How would you know if it was one or the other?
Well, in some ways you might not know completely. There are some things that would be similar with the bacteria and the blue-green algae toxins. You can have gastrointestinal issues, diarrhea, things like that. The other things with the blue-green algae toxins is you have more dermatological issues, skin rashes. There can be some concerns for the liver if you would ingest a large amount. Mm-hmm. We characteristically don't see that, but so it can be a variety of things. There can be some neurological issues, some confusion, a weakness, some of those issues you would see more in an animal, a dog that would be lapping up the water or cleaning off their fur after they got into the lake that had an algae bloom and then being exposed out of a large amount. So they would have more of the neurological issues and maybe even liver failure.
Mm. Peter Thorne, a professor and head of the Occupational Environmental Health at the UI, excuse me. Talk about this. We haven't had real heat yet so far this year. We've had some very pleasant weather in the last few days, but as always, we expect some heat. Talk about the growth of this algae that produces toxin as the heat goes up in our temperature.
Surely. Well, Mary alluded to the fact that the warm and still water helps promote the growth of this cyanobacteria, as we know it. We frequently refer to harmful algal blooms and this blue-green algae, but it's really a cyanobacteria, and that's what produces the microcystin toxin. And there's evidence suggesting that a warming climate is producing an increase in the growth of these harmful algal blooms. And a very good example of that is what happened in 2014 and 2011 in Toledo, Ohio, in the western basin of Lake Erie, which is fairly shallow. And the higher temperatures cause more stratification of temperature across various depths of the water so that you don't get as much mixing. And then the high heat, the cyanobacteria outcompete other organisms that have a niche in that environment, and then they take off. And they can have these explosive growths where they grow to depths of 2 or 3 inches thick. And that's when, and then when they die, they release these microcystins. And in that case, the water is not suitable for drinking, cooking or bathing, and the microcystins, you can't boil the water
because
and make
it's
safe.
Not a biological agent to kill, is it?
It's a biological agent. It's not a micro. It's not a living organism.
Okay, so you can't kill it by boiling.
Right. It's a very heat stable chemical produced by these bacteria, and so you just simply lose that source of water. And in the case of Toledo, 500,000 people without water.
Mm-hmm. So what lessons can we draw from 2014 in Toledo for Iowa? What is the red flag for us here in Iowa?
Well, there's short-term and long-term lessons. The short-term is it certainly reinforces the work that Stu and Mary are doing to ensure the safety of our bathers and those using recreational water in the state. The other lesson, of course, is that we really need to seek to make changes in our land use so that we control the inputs to our water systems of phosphorus and nitrogen, but especially phosphorus coming from fertilizer, animal manure, livestock production, and in some cases septic systems that are poorly controlled. Those inputs, if we can curtail that, it would really reduce the nutrient loading in the water that promotes the growth of these bacteria, these cyanobacteria.
Join our conversation as we talk about recreational water quality here in Iowa. If you boat, swim, ski on the water, or fish even, well, we want to talk about that a little bit later. Join our conversation with your questions, your comments, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you've had a run-in with E. coli after swimming, or you suppose that's what it was, or one of these toxins. Let's hear about your experience. 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. By the way, when we put this podcast up a little later today at iowapublicradio.org, we're going to give you a link where you can check the latest results of testing at any beach in the state, nearly 40 beaches, Mary. And then that testing, you said, is done on a weekly basis.
That's right. So what we do is we sample on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And then for the algal toxins, I take those back to the lab on Thursday, run the samples, and then release those results, usually on Thursday, sometimes on Friday. We have both the web page as well as a hotline, so people can call the hotline at 515-725-3434 and get the latest results that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can get them off the web, contacting the hotline, as you just mentioned, Mary. But what if we go to a beach area, and because it's only once per week that these areas are tested, I suppose it's possible that dangers, hazards, water quality hazards can pop up very quickly or not?
You're right, Ben. So these things can pop up quite quickly. So if we sampled on Monday and things looked fine, maybe the conditions were windy, things get calm by Wednesday or Thursday, we do ask people to be, you know, vigilant about what they're looking at when they go to the beach. So if the water looks very green and scummy, thick, as it were, or if it's blue-green in color, that people really use the adage, better safe than sorry. When in doubt, stay out. We don't know whether it's toxic. Not all of these blue-green algae are producing toxins at all times. We really have to run the test to know whether or not they're producing toxin. But it's a safe, better safe than sorry scenario where we recommend that people keep themselves out and they keep their pets out of that water. If it just doesn't look very good, if it's got that green color to it, just better to stay out of it.
Mm-hmm. Of course, many, many dogs love to have a splash, love to swim around, many of them. Peter Thorne, why is this especially a danger for pets?
Well, when you and I are swimming together in a lake, we would typically have dermal exposure, but we certainly try not to take much of the water into our mouth, whereas pets, particularly dogs exercising, are certainly going to drink the water. And they also groom after they come out, and so residues of the cyanobacteria on their fur would be ingested. And these are much more toxic. The dose is higher when one takes it by ingestion rather than dermal exposure or inhalation. And there can be inhalation exposure too, particularly when you have harmful algal blooms on oceans or Great Lakes where you get big surf and the mist. They can become inhalation hazards, and so that's also of great concern.
Mm-hmm. Mary, how many calls do you get? How much is your office contacted about people wondering if they see something in the water? They may see a blanket or a carpet or something, I guess, that looks like paint, and they wonder what it is. Do you get that often?
We do. We get dozens of calls at this time of year where people are wondering whether the beaches are safe, and they see something on the water, whether they can go in and swim or not. And so whether it's a state park beach, as well as there's lots and lots of private little ponds, there's county beaches, not everything is being tested out there. So, you know, we're reporting on the state-owned beaches, but people have their own farm pond, and they often get these blue-green algae blooms as well. And so We get calls from private landowners who want to know what's going on. We can't always test all those waters, but we can give them advice about what to do and how to treat that water.
Right, and about public awareness, I think sometimes you really have to look for the notices. And that last year, I went to, I guess this is a county park with a lake, pond, lake, but there were some rather tattered notices up on the main bulletin board that were sort of hard to see, I have to say, that there were blue-green algae, that you had to stay out of the water. You should not fish in the water. I took a walk around this pond, and there was a man with his dog. The dog was frolicking in the water. I quickly ran down and said, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. You need to hose your dog off. You could have a very sad incident here. And that's right. So do we have to work, do you think, Mary, on better raising of awareness?
I think we do have to raise awareness. You know, thankfully, we haven't had a lot of issues in terms of people illness, as Stu said, and dog deaths, but it is a possibility. And as Peter indicated, we do think that with climate change that we're going to see more of this. And so we would like to make sure that people are aware of it and precautions to take. That's not to say that people shouldn't recreate in Iowa's waters, but it's like anything. You should take safety precautions. I recommend to people to bring a towel to wipe their dog off. Dogs seem to be especially drawn to these nasty blooms because dogs like funky smelling things, and so they get into it. So, you know, taking those precautions, raising the awareness. We've been trying to work with hunters because if they have dogs, a lot of times these blooms happen late in the season. Sometimes after we're done testing, our testing ends on Labor Day, people are still recreating and they're still their hunting dogs may especially still be in those waters. So raising awareness is a big part of this overall issue in trying to help people make the best decisions possible.
Mm-hmm. Stu Schmidt, state toxicologist, when we talk about the toxins produced by this bacteria that we call blue-green algae, cytotoxins, does that necessarily coincide with what we see, the highest concentration of toxins when we see the real blanket of blue-green algae?
No, it doesn't have to. Like we've discussed before, most of the times the toxins are going to be released when the individual cells of the cyanobacteria die off, and so that's going to be the time when the blooms would start to diminish. So there can be times of high toxin levels in the water when you don't see a lot of the bloom, or after the bloom has been passed. They can come and go kind of quickly, and so sometimes the toxin levels can be at the end of the bloom.
Mm-hmm. So where do the toxins then go? The bacteria die off. The water eventually cools as we head into the fall season. Why do the toxins disappear?
Well, they're fairly stable, but it's just the natural flow of the lakes mixing in with the rest of the water body. So it would be a dilution. If there's an outlet for the lake, it's going to continue that way. So it'd just be the natural process of things after things flow through a lake. I would diminish.
Mm-hmm. So Peter Thorne, jump in.
Yeah,
here.
So the microcystin LR, the one that is most commonly monitored and perhaps the most toxic, as Stu was saying, is very stable, has a half-life of about 10 weeks, but we don't see it persisting typically for 10 weeks' time in a given body of water that's for recreation for the reasons that Stu was saying. There's flow, and I think some of it sediments too and goes down to the sediments where over a long time it will degrade.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller in St. Charles. Kate is with us. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. Talking about recreational water quality, 1-866-780-9100. Kate, welcome to River.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
We're good. You use the water for recreation. What's on your mind?
I sure do. I used to work at the DNR, and I want to thank Mary and Stu for all their good work. But the state has a nutrient, you know, the real thing is the algae needs something to eat. And the nutrient addition from agricultural runoff is supposed to be being managed through our state nutrient strategy, which my understanding is was written by the Farm Bureau. So it has no teeth. And basically I'm wondering, how can we ever improve our water quality until we really get serious about nutrient strategy? That is limiting the nutrients that are running off through the tiles from the farms and other sources.
Other sources are yards. If we like to have a nice green yard and we have someone come every week or two to spray it down, that stuff finds its way also into the system, too. Kate, thank you very much. Let's ask Peter Thorne about that. This is the nutrient reduction strategy we've talked about on this show many times. It's a voluntary reduction strategy. Do you see our government, our legislators, our governor doing enough here, Peter Thorne?
Well, you know, that's a very controversial issue. You point to lawn. I think the estimates I've seen are 85% or more is agriculture. Lawns contribute maybe 15% to overall statewide to the nutrient loading. It's very clear that there are a number of land use strategies in agriculture we could adopt that would reduce the nutrient loading of our surface waters, and that you know, voluntary programs have not been very successful. So there's a lot of approaches that have been suggested to make some requirements of agricultural lands to better control nutrients, or to provide more people in DNR to inspect that. The EPA has been in contact with Iowa's DNR over the last few years about a failure to adequately enforce the Clean Water Act and some of the with regard to nutrient loading. So it's been a big issue in the state, and I think, you know, you've covered it a lot, as you say, and it's been part of the issue having to do with the Des Moines Water Works suit over the drain tiles and the nutrient loading of streams.
Right, the Des Moines Water Works case, yes. We've discussed many times, three Iowa counties being sued by the Des Moines Water Works to help pay to remove, is it nitrates?
Right, predominantly nitrates. But, of course, those bodies of water and Sailorville Dam also are subject to harmful algal blooms and high E. coli levels, and so it's all part of the same story. The nutrients give rise to those water contaminants that have serious public health effects.
Quickly, before we go to break, Mary Skopek of the DNR, how much do you see the fact that Iowa is an agricultural state as contributing to our water quality problems?
Well, certainly the fact that we have a working landscape. A lot of states have a lot more sort of natural areas set aside, and Iowa's a working landscape. So that's something we have to recognize, understand, and start to come up with better technologies. The one thing I would throw out is the Toledo issue that Peter addressed earlier. One of the things that we learned in that whole bloom that happened was that soluble reactive phosphorus, which is just a fancy way of saying phosphorus that's dissolved in the water, was much more of a problem with Lake Erie than people ever knew, even 10 years ago. And so the science is evolving very rapidly in understanding these harmful algal blooms, and we really need to continue to tweak our systems and understand better what the true drivers are.
Okay, we'll come back and talk more about recreational water quality here in Iowa and the Midwest. If you fish, you boat, you swim, you ski on our lakes, on our rivers, you let your dog take a dip on a hot summer day, this is an hour that you need to pay attention to. And we'd like to have you join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. We'll get back to those callers in just a moment. It's River to River.
Support for IPR comes.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about recreational water quality. As the temperatures warm up and we like to seek those bodies of water, this information from University of Northern Iowa Center for Social and Behavioral Research, attitudes about water quality 85% of Iowans reported having visited a lake, a river, a creek in Iowa during the past 2 years for recreational purposes, swimming, boating, fishing, perhaps you too. So it's of critical importance for most of us here in Iowa, the large majority, that we have good water quality. And we're talking about hazards that we may find in the water perhaps at a pond or stream or lake near you. Joining us, Mary Skopek is beach monitoring coordinator and geologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Peter Thorne, professor and head of the Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of Iowa. Stuart Schmidt, state toxicologist for the Iowa Department of Public Health. We are going to get to callers in a few minutes. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go, in fact, right now to one of our callers, Ralph. Ralph Rosenberg is with us. He's director of the Iowa Environmental Council. Thanks for calling in, Ralph.
Well, thanks for having the show, Ben.
And tell us, you've been listening, I assume, to the last few minutes of the program. What do you want to pitch in?
Well, there was an ultimate lack of meaningful action by state government this past year. I mean, you saw an absence of permanent funding. You saw an absence of efforts for both recreational and drinking water improvements. We didn't see any efforts to strengthen the nutrient reduction strategy. We didn't fund the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. We didn't see efforts for accountability. We did not see progress. We do hope that since this is a campaign year, that the citizens of Iowa and your listeners ask our candidates how they're going to achieve clean water, ask our candidates how they're going to fund it, and ask our candidates how to make programs accountable. Because if they don't, we're only going to see an increase in the record number of beach closures, and we're only going to see an increase in the record number of impaired rivers.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, what do you think are the what's holding up actions and our legislature? What are the forces there that you believe are responsible for not improving our water quality?
Well, one of the forces is the need to convince public officials of the urgency. There's always competing needs for funding, but there's a need for urgency for clean water. And there's been proposals for permanent sustainable funding that were proposed by and approved by a constitutional amendment 6 years ago. I think we have to refresh the memories of elected officials, and we have to make sure that it is higher up on the candidates and the elected officials' priority list. While there's always this competing debate over funding for education and human services, and we certainly understand that, we have not made progress, and we're going backwards on recreational waters and drinking waters. So I think in part it's the urgency. I think part is the understanding of the urgency. I think in part it's elected officials need to get the permission by their constituents to speak out and speak out within their own political caucuses and speak out on the campaign trail. And they need to get not just permission, but also the pressure to speak out at the Capitol that this is what the public wants. Because when you were talking about the percentages of the public that visit the beaches, we also know the high percentage of the public that supports solutions like the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then looking at this back at this UNI Center for Social and Behavioral Research survey, attitudes about water quality, another statistic, an overwhelming majority of Iowans, 85% agreed, means agreed or strongly agreed that clean water was needed for economic growth in Iowa. So it can be, how many people want to move to a state and work at a place where the water quality is in question?
Yeah, there's no question that there's this connection between economics and clean water. And I think the UNI study, and as well as your previous speakers, understand the connection. That is, there's a public health concern, but closely coupled with the public health concern is the overall connection with economics. We want Iowa to be a state where there is constant improvement in our rivers and our lakes, not a stale status quo effort. And I think the public does want to see the funding. They want to see sustainable funding. They want to make sure the funding is well spent. They'd like to see water quality testing. We want to see some benchmarks. I think the public understands it may not be cleaned up overnight, but they want to see progress, and we haven't seen that kind of progress.
Okay, thank you very much, Ralph Rosenberg, Director of the Iowa Environmental Council. Thanks for calling in, Ralph.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Sioux City in northwest Iowa. Wilbur is with us in Sioux City. Hi, Wilbur. What do you make of this conversation? Does it directly impact you?
It sure does. I was on vacation last summer up in Mason City, and it's no wonder that those people turned down that big pork plant because the water stunk up there so bad in that Winnebago River. Our kids couldn't, their grandkids couldn't even swim in it. They wanted to take us canoeing, and we're like, no, we're not going in that water.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this last guy that talked, problem is all these politicians are bought off by these big ag companies, and they're not going to do anything. I mean, the farmers, you give them money to plant, you give them money not to plant. Until the price of corn exceeds the cost of production so bad that they're not going to make any money, Nothing's going to ever get done.
Well, Wilbur, we are an agricultural state. Livestock and corn and beans out there drive our economic machines. How do we find some middle ground? How do we have both clean water and a thriving agricultural economy?
What you do is you put a surtax on anybody that sells anything related to ag in this state. So if these chemical companies are going to make billions of dollars, you're going to charge them up front to clean the water up from the very beginning. That's what you're going to do.
Okay.
And the politicians are going to have to pass the laws to get that done. Because I'm, as a taxpayer, I'm getting tired. Our water rates just went up in Sioux City, 6.65%. Okay? I'm on a fixed income. I'm planning to clean up the water that the people upriver are polluting, and that's not fair.
Okay, Wilbur, thank you very much.
These guys got to take some responsibility.
Thank you. Thank you. Wilbur in Sioux City. Let's go to Beth in Urbandale. Beth, what's your observation for us today?
Hi. Well, we grew up in Iowa and know that this is not a new issue. We moved to Minnesota in the early 90s, and when we decided that we wanted to buy a cabin up there, we were able to, and you still can, go to the Minnesota DNR website, and you can get an exhaustive review of nearly every lake in the state. You can get a SECI reading, which tells you the clarity of it. You can get all kinds of detail about the lake quality. And we go north enough that we don't have agricultural runoff to our lake. Otherwise, I would love to have a place that we could recreate in a state where my grandchildren would be safe to swim and my dog would be safe to swim. As a resident up there 25 years ago, we could buy lawn fertilizers that didn't have phosphorus or nitrogen in them. Mm-hmm. In fact, many areas you couldn't even purchase those kinds of products because they were so intense even long ago. So it's really frustrating to move back in 2000 and we're still hearing this conversation.
Beth in Urbandale, thank you for your observation comparison with Minnesota. Mary Skopek, can you give us any view on how Iowa compares to other states in terms of information? Beth said up in Minnesota you can find information about all kinds of waterways up there that may be near you. Is Iowa giving out the information that it needs to have people's awareness raised?
Well, I'm not exactly sure the format that Minnesota's putting their information out in, but in Iowa, for example, our lakes, so we sample the 40 beaches, but then we sample almost 150 public lakes, and we sample those three times a year. We put reports out about that particular information. Our website has gone through some changes, and I can't quite honestly say how easy it is to find for the average person the information on the website, but it is available. And so we encourage people to go to the DNR webpage to look at the information. Iowa State University does most of our lake sampling for us, and I know that they have information on their webpage as well. So again, I think it's a matter of, you know, us making sure at the DNR that that information is as accessible as possible, as understandable as possible by the public, and we are certainly working on that to try and make sure people can get their hands on it. We've had a very extensive monitoring program for over a decade now, and really had been leaders in doing a lot of lake testing. And in fact, it was really that lake monitoring that helped to spur, along with an economic study, a lake restoration program that at times has put almost $10 million into lake restoration in Iowa. And we've seen some pretty good success stories around the state where some of those lakes have gotten appreciably better in terms of water quality when the funding, when the ability to go after that lake has happened.
Mm-hmm. Peter Thorne, you wanted to react to something Mary said or one of the callers said.
Well, I'm reacting both to Beth and to Mary. Beth, who called and said that Minnesota has this information. Under the Clean Water Act, Section 303D provides for a biennial listing by state of impaired waters. So in the process of compiling that, I presume Mary and her colleagues gather a lot of data on bacterial loading and turbidity and pH and a whole host of factors classifying lakes, and then decides on five categories to define those lakes, whether they met all designated uses and are therefore not impaired, or at the other extreme are severely impaired. And I did recently look at the 2014 data for Iowa on 1,316 water bodies that were reported by IDNR.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1-866-780-9100. Peter Thorne, we want to mention before this program is out that you are not only an environmental researcher, specialist here as professor and head of occupational environmental health at the UI, but you have a real firsthand contact. You and I share a love of open water swimming, so we get in the water, perhaps you could say like a dog almost, to enjoy it. When you go out and see a potential lake to swim in, what are you looking at first and foremost for your own safety?
Well, as you know, we always have a swimsuit and a pair of goggles with us no matter where we go. So anything that's wet and bigger than a puddle looks like a potential swimming place, whether it be salt water or fresh water. And so when I'm looking at a body of water that I want to swim in, curiously, we worry less about temperature than we worry about maybe the quality of the water. I like to have a nice, clear, non-turbid lake where I can see the end of my arm when I'm stroking.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that it's
low. That's also an indication of how much algae is in there, isn't it?
Algae as well as suspended solids from erosion and other sources of migration of soil into the water. We like to hope it's low in bacteria, and certainly the microcystins and cystins and the harmful algal blooms are a growing concern that we have. But there's nothing like swimming in open water in the sunshine on a beautiful day and with some waves to make it more interesting, and I'll take that over a pool any day.
All right. Frank is with us in Fairfield as we discuss recreational water quality in Iowa. Frank, what's your input?
Well, we have a public beach in Fairfield maintained by the city and volunteers, and we have continually over the last 10 years or so had a problem with the Canadian geese and their droppings, and I wonder how much that contributes to the water quality problem, to reducing the water quality.
Mm-hmm. Frank, we talked about that a little bit earlier in the program, but perhaps Mary can reiterate there that the DNR is trying, of course. This is our wildlife. We love our geese, our ducks, and so forth, but we want to lower the impact that their droppings have, right, Mary?
That's exactly right. And so we do know that the droppings can have an impact on bacteria levels as well as they have nutrients in them. And so whatever we can do to remove that geese dropping from the beach, that's a positive thing. And where we've been able to do that a lot, we've seen some pretty good improvements in beach water quality. So we encourage people to think about how they can get out there and remove those geese droppings.
Okay, so if you have a farm, you have a private little pond or something like that, it would be good to go out there and regularly collect those before the rain washes them into the pond.
It is. And the other thing is to think about providing habitat that is discourages the geese from being right near your beach or where you're trying to recreate. So they don't like tall grass. Can you plant tall prairie grasses? That discourages them from loafing and hanging out there.
Mm-hmm. Stuart Schmitz, let me ask you, as we go back to the threat of the toxins, as you are the state toxicologist, what do you see in the future with climate change and these bacteria, which are called blue-green algae? Do you see them being a problem that we'll just have to live with, an increasing problem that we'll just have to live with?
Well, they'll certainly be a problem. This isn't anything new, particularly. They've existed a long time. We would anticipate with warmer weather, more rain runoff, that it would be a continual problem. And that's, I guess that's in my thinking, we need to do extra work to control the runoff, to have activities at a farm level that can be implemented to maintain the runoff, to slow down that so it absorbs into the ground. It's a continual problem, and it may be exacerbated if we do not take action. And one thing I would like to point out, there's a debate on what kind of implementation we need to do in the state, whether it should be regulated or a voluntary program, and I think a combination of those. But I'd like to point out too that I've been involved in this and have said on the meetings, and we are doing more than we ever have. It's just a question of whether it's going to be fast enough, whether we're doing the right work.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the outset that many of our state's waterways are impaired. They're on a list of impaired water. Peter Thorne, there are certainly a lot of other things that can impair water besides the things we're talking about this hour. Can you just tell us what puts just under half of our state's waterways on the impaired water list?
Yes, yeah, so sure, I can say something about this. So out of the 1,316 water bodies that are assessed in 2014, 724 were judged to be severely impaired, and 7 were judged to meet all designated uses and therefore are not impaired. So that's not a great record, and the numbers of impaired waters have been increasing rather than decreasing for a variety of reasons, some of which might be better ascertainment of the water quality.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Mary Skopak, increasing impaired waters? What do you see driving that, and how do we reverse that trend?
So impaired waters are really a combination of more monitoring and changing standards. So it's a little bit of a red herring to look at just the number of impaired waters, because without monitoring, you don't have impaired waters. You don't have anything to compare to. So I tend not to focus on that number in particular, but to look at what the numbers are telling us in terms of what the level of nitrogen is or what the level of phosphorus is. We don't have standards for those in the state of Iowa right now, so they wouldn't show up, say, on an impaired waters list. So that, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that the impaired waters list is a bit of a bureaucratic exercise as opposed to maybe a full assessment of water quality.
Mm. But it does suggest that I think most of the impairments are due to high bacteria, contaminating biological agents, or noted fish kills. And so, you know, to the extent that those are the three major reasons for listing as a severe impairment is significant. It points mm-hmm. to where the concerns might lie and the solutions might lie.
Let me ask the three of you before we say goodbye for this hour. Do you notice, and I'll use this word, watershed moment, mm-hmm. are we in Iowa reaching a point where over the last year, water quality has become a big issue? Is something going to happen, do you think? Awareness has been raised so that we are going to make some meaningful changes here, Peter Thorne?
Well, I'm concerned that some people view it as a hopeless entity, that they've seen the water quality not improve despite rhetoric, and then they see years come by with legislative initiatives that simply die. And then we hear voices like we heard from Wilbur in Sioux City, where very pessimistic about the future. I would like to hope that as things get more acute through climate change having a greater impact on harmful algal blooms and the nutrient problems, that finally we'll come to a point where we can start to make a difference. I'm not sure we're at that tipping point yet.
Mm-hmm. Mary Skopak, what is your outlook?
I tend to be a little bit more optimistic. One of the things that I do as well as the beach monitoring is to work with citizens that want to learn how to do water quality testing. And, you know, if the number of people who call me who want to learn how to do testing and then use those results to improve water quality is any indication, I think people are ready to make a change and to see things get better. And so I'm hopeful that because we're having these conversations, as Stu said, we're getting more conversation than ever. I think we will see some changes happening
okay.
in the future.
Okay, Mary, this would be a good way to end this program and find out how can we do some self-testing in the waters that may be in our neighborhood, maybe in the area that we live.
So we have the program called iWater, all one word, I-O-W-A-T-E-R. We hold training sessions, and actually on Friday we'll be holding a training session at Jester Park near Des Moines. Folks will come out and learn in 8 hours how to do basic water quality testing. So I encourage people to get involved with the iWater program to become knowledgeable and proficient at understanding water quality in their local area.
Thank you very much, Mary Skopak, Beach Monitoring Coordinator and Geologist for the Iowa DNR. Stuart Schmitz, State Toxicologist for the Iowa Department of Public Health. Thank you for being with us this hour as well, Stuart.
Yes, thank you.
And Peter Thorne, Professor and Head of Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of Iowa. Good to have you come into our studio. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, tomorrow, Wednesday, Politics Day, we'll be looking at the primaries taking place today and the outcomes, and I look forward to our general election. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.